This is Ryan.
And this is Wayne.
And this is Kill the Rabbit Podcast after 3 months. So, we had a huge hurricane a couple weeks back, 3 weeks ago.
Seems like forever, but...
Yeah, it's been crazy. I thought my house was going to flood, and I live... My elevation's like 152 feet, which didn't even make sense. But it came up three-quarters up the driveway, so we started stacking chairs on tables and prepped everything. I went to sleep Saturday night and told my wife, I don't want to look. I'm just going to go to sleep. Because all that day had been tornado warning, tornado warning. There were like 155 tornado warnings. So you just get so stressed out. You know, the first 20 times we were downstairs in the bathroom, but then the rest of them, you're just like, I don't even care. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen. So, and then thinking about it architecturally, I don't even know that my bathroom is the best place downstairs underneath the stairs. Yeah, it's the most central part of my house, but the way my house is structured, it doesn't seem like it would really do much protecting. So we thought about that. So then you like don't have anywhere to go. And then a tornado did hit off Barker Cypress. It ripped it didn't rip the roof off. It just a hole in the roof. But still, I'm sure when that happened, I'm sure it was terrifying.
Sure.
So we didn't flood. My in-laws flooded. So like almost 4 feet of water in the house for a week. So cleaned it out. You were there to help, which was awesome.
Pulling out wet, soggy carpet.
Which is super heavy.
Cutting up the sheetrock to get rid of the mold. Lots of fun stuff.
Yeah. So, and it all kind of happened all... So, when Harvey hit, right before that, I had done a final interview with a company that I was interviewing with. Because I'd been it's not that I've been actively looking. It's just that I was kind of on the way out because I didn't want to do C#.net stuff anymore. Because I was kind of forced to do it in the position that I was at. So I think the worst thing, which I've talked about before, was just doing the conversion of all my code from Python to C#, which took three times as long because the way C# is structured. Like, in Python, you do things and you do it, you do rapid development and you just see if it works, and if it doesn't, you tweak it. So like by the time I'm on my fifth iteration, you've done your first iteration in C#, because you have to make sure everything matches. And they don't plan for let me put it this way. In Python, you ask forgiveness, not permission. And in C#, you ask permission, not forgiveness. So you never really have a like a breaking failure. The paradigm is very different between the two languages. Like, the point of developing software is you're going to keep enhancing it cycle after cycle, right? So you're not going to write it correctly or the best way the first time.
Right.
So Python is of the mindset of, well, the faster that I can fail, the faster I can learn from my mistake and do something about it. So, like in Python, I'll try something, and if it fails, I do something about it. Whereas in C#, it doesn't want you to fail. It's just a mindset of
failure
things, right?
Is not an option.
Right. And so then you have to, I guess, the equivalent is you have to plan for all the edge cases, whereas in Python, I don't care. Mm-hmm. So, I was in the final interview of that, and I think they made... No, yeah. Then the hurricane hit. Then all the tornado stuff, and then her parents had to get rescued by the Coast Guard on Monday, so then they were at our house. And it was funny, because I was talking to my wife, and she was like, did we even talk about, like, them staying with us? And I guess you're in such an emergency, you don't even think about it. It's just something that you do. So, and we had a room, so we kind of moved her office to my office, which is fine, and so they have a place to stay, and dealing with the trauma, and it's almost like dealing with a person that has had a death near them, where they go through all those stages of grief, where, you know, the person would say, I'm gonna go to my house tomorrow to do stuff. It's like, well, that's not gonna happen because you can't even get there because there's still 5-6 feet of water in the street. So like dealing with all that, and then you know, when you see something yourself, you have that realization where it really hits. And so he, you know, went and visited, and then it really hit the gravity of the situation.
Right.
Where it's not just, because you're positive, right? So in the beginning, it's, there's no water in the house. Okay. I'm not going to say anything that's going to, like, make you feel worse. Right. But I know that that's just not the case. But I'm not going to be that person. So it's been an interesting emotional ride. And especially with, you know, me getting this job, and then you have, and then, you know, you have survivor guilt because you didn't get flooded, but they did. They lost all the cars, all the furniture, all their clothes, every single thing except 3 pairs of clothes. And so, and then we didn't lose anything, and I just got a new job that's work from home and better than the job that I had. So then you kind of have this guilt complex that happened. And then my wife just got another job that's awesome at a hospital. So you feel guilty because, right. but I think we're blessed so that we can help them.
Be a blessing. Yeah. Blessed to be a blessing. Yeah, that's really true. I wasn't feeling so much survivor's guilt. I was feeling, I tend to be empathetic. That's just the way I'm wired, I guess. And I'm feeling to what extent I could. Obviously, I've never lost to the extent that they lost. And I still remember the feeling that I had going through their house and trying to help stick stuff in bags and throw stuff away. And I'm in the master bedroom. I'm looking at things and I'm thinking, you know, we're throwing away these things that are, this is their life, you know. And started to make me tear up because I just thought, wow, this is too much.
Yeah.
You know, and yet, you know, these things happen. And so you're there. You're there for them. You're there with them. And for whatever length of time it takes to make whatever adjustments they're going to have to make, and it's not going to come easy, and it's not going to be a short-term thing.
No.
It's kind of like one of the things I thought about funerals in America. Somebody made a comment to me one time. They said, you know, the grieving process from start to finish, you know, when the person dies, and then there's the people come in from out of town and they make things for you, and then there's the funeral. And in America, we try to hurry things along.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, for the person who's lost something, it goes on and mm-hmm. on and mm-hmm. on. And so it takes a while.
Yeah.
And they're going to take a while to adjust. It's just a good thing you guys have been able to give them a place to stay. But
yeah, it's been a ride. But I mean, the good news is that the job did come through. So I start Monday, and being that it's remote, it's awesome because then I am there just in case we need to do something. Or like with the house, it's just with their house, it's constant visiting and checking. And you know, then you have the mold issue, and now next is the roof. So you have to check the roof because wind blew water under the shingles and you had roof leaks, and then dealing with insurance, and then dealing with the cars. And it just makes you realize how much stuff that you accumulate in your life, and there's no way to describe it. But the good thing is that those things did go well for us to be able to be a blessing to them, and I think it's going to be fine. It's going to be a long process. So I mean, we have roommates for at least 6 months, if not longer, depending on how long it's going to take. And you know, there's a lot of people that are way worse off. There, you know, were people that died, and then there were other people that they have no family here, so they've been in a hotel for a month, And that's and paying their mortgage. And some of them have gotten apartments, so they're paying a mortgage and $1,600-$1,700 a month on an apartment because the apartment complexes know that there's a lot of people looking for rent and supply and demand. I don't know if they're meaning to jack up the price, but it's been a nightmare for Houston. And then Irma hit right after and flooded them out. They were probably worse than us because I think 32 million people had to evacuate in Florida. So it's just, and then earthquakes for this, like the other day, earthquake in Mexico City. So it's been a wild ride. I haven't really worked on the realm. And the funny thing about the realm, though, is in talking to the job, they were really interested in the realm, which I found, I've never talked to a company that actually cared about that. And to give a backstory, I have almost 10 years' experience. So I was like, let me do what I want with my resume now. Because before, you talk to recruiters and they're like, okay, highlight this, drop this, add this, all this stuff. So I was like, I've been in the market long enough. I'm going to do whatever I want now. So I have my experience and all the other stuff. But then at the end, I decided I'm going to put personal projects. The recruiter commented on it and was like, wow, I've never, in all my years of doing recruiting, have ever seen anyone put personal projects on a resume. And I find it fascinating. And I was like, please do tell, because every recruiter that looks at my resume could not care less. They don't even know, 9 times out of 10, they don't even read my resume. They just do a keyword match. They're like, oh, that, match that, okay, we're good. But she read it all, and she said, it tells me a lot about you as a person. That not only do you do it and you do it well professionally, but you enjoy it enough to do it for free. So I was like, that's very cool. And the client, the job, commented on it as well. And the funny thing, and I told you this the other day, and it's really kind of funny for me, that they were very concerned about the amount of time that I would be spending on my personal project. And I was like, wow, you don't know me at all. Like, that's not an issue. My issue is doing the project, right? That's the actual problem. So in talking to them, they commented on that, and so yeah, it's been an interesting time, to say the least.
That's neat. Well, I've been busy, of course, going back to the flood thing. It's interesting how different events in your life end up taking up lots of time, and if you didn't have a lot of time to begin with, and then what time you did have was taken up by that. And my body was rebelling against helping a little bit because I found myself being really sore and really tired, and I was probably overdoing it in some cases. But getting back to the writing has been a challenge. But you know, I've said this before, I've needed to learn to persevere, to hang in there and not quit. And even if you go for a period of time and you find yourself, like I was, feeling kind of placed because I had all this stuff going on and everything, and it's been easy for me to just kind of slip away from doing and getting back on track. So I'm actually getting excited about getting back on track again and cranking it back up, starting the writing again, which I think anyone would say the farther you get away from something, the longer you get away from something that you've been doing. It's like coals on a fire. They begin to die out, and it's more difficult to get the flames back again, and the passion and ignited. And that's why it's so important to just keep at it. And I'm preaching to myself right now because I'm the one that needs it, is to just stay at it. Don't give up. Don't quit, even with the distractions. And life is full of distractions. And I think sometimes those distractions you may even call them a test, testing you to see what's really the most valuable to you in your life. What are you paying most of your attention to? Is it stuff that isn't that valuable to you? It's just stuff you have to do, and that's a really easy grind to get into. Mm-hmm. Well, I got to pay the bills. I got to mow the lawn. I've got to go to work every day. Well, that's true. But in the midst of all that, have you lost sight of the things that really are burning inside that need to be dealt with?
Well, and also, there's the passion side of it that I agree with. But then the newest thing that I've kind of discovered is, like, the analytics side of it. So, like, everything you do, like, you go to work for 8 hours, you drive to work. There's a lot of logistics involved. You can't just work for 8 hours straight. You have to take a break and go to lunch. All those things can be calculated more or less. So, like, with doing what I'm doing with the Realm, not that the Realm is the business focus that I'm trying to start a company doing that. I mean, it would be great, but I think it's a little bit too big of an undertaking at this time without, like, a team. I think that's, like, second company, third company, but or maybe not, I don't know. But I was thinking about, okay, so looking at it from an analytics standpoint, what's the main driver for starting a business? For myself, to replace my income. Okay, so you know your income, so you take that X amount of dollars a month, that's what you're trying to hit. So then walking it back from there to, okay, what is, you can't charge $1,000 a month for a product. Typically, no one's going to buy it. It's too expensive, especially in software. You can't charge 10 cents. That's too small. People value the product based on what they pay for it at times. So sometimes you're doing yourself a disservice by, say, giving something away for free because they equate it with a value of zero. So kind of knowing where your product market fit is and knowing where your price point is. So, you know, for myself, I was doing analysis and I was like, okay, I could do a product like a software as a service that you would sell on a subscription basis at like $10 a month or $100 a year. So you pay the year, you save $20, $10 a month. It's not a lot of money for most people to part with if you're providing that value that they need and whatever it is they're using your service for. So then stepping back from that, you realize, hey, I don't need a billion customers. You know what I'm saying? Sure. To make $100,000, you don't need a billion customers. You need like 1,000. Or depending on what you charge, right? So hitting 1,000 customers is a much more achievable goal than hitting 6 billion. So doing those types of analytics, I feel, has been missing from that side. And then having that analytics be a driver in what it is that you are doing. So, like, if I'm going to develop something, if I was like, I'm going to start a game company and write games. Well, that's great for your passion. That's horrible for execution or analytics, right?
Sure.
To be profitable as a game company, it's very cutthroat. It's very hard. It's a lot of hours, and it's not just one person. Unless you have a very niche market, which is like indie game stuff, which is not going to be any of the super high-res graphics and awesome tools that you pay hundreds of thousands of dollars a month for, or a year at least. So you know from the analytics side that drives that to say, no, that's not a good decision.
Right.
So, and on the artistic side, it's like, pick something super simple that people want. The other thing, I was listening to a podcast and he said use Market Samurai, which is a like a piece of software that you put keywords in it and it will tell you the frequency that people have been searching for that keyword. So you would know, oh, there's a lot of people searching for this. And then you go Google it yourself and you say, hey, there's not a lot of offerings for this. Like, this is the guy that I was telling you about, and I don't know if I've talked about this before, but he had noticed that there's a huge void in the market for people searching for information on how to become a security guard per state. because every state has different regulations.
Hmm.
So he did Market Samurai, I guess, or something similar to it, and discovered, hey, there's like nobody offering this information. So he went to all 50 states and gathered the information and put it in packets for like $100 or $10 or whatever. And it makes six figures a month because there's nobody else doing the work. And especially in a digital age, if I have to click something, if I have three steps to do something, for most people, that's too much.
You know, that's really interesting. I just kind of a thing. My sister used to work for the government and worked for the county. This is up in Wisconsin. And she used to get these elderly, especially women, who would come in, and they were beside themselves. There was problems. The taxes on their homes were killing them, and they needed some counseling on what to do with their current situation. Should I move out of my house, get into an apartment? Where do I find the money to do such and such? Well, my sister was a wealth of information because she had done the footwork to find out what government programs offered certain people in certain situations. And so she was able to offer it to them. And just like what you're saying with this guy, you could Google all day long, and you'd really kind of have to know and be patient,
mm-hmm.
because the government doesn't really make it very easy for you to find out stuff.
Mm-mm.
And so again, another situation where if you can find something that is in great demand, like you say with the word search, if you find people that seem to be looking for a lot of stuff, and then you can find that one niche,
mm-hmm.
that you may be the only guy on the block that could provide it.
Well, and that's the thing that I've said before about why I live in Houston and not Austin. In Austin, there's a high competition rate for software engineers because they're coming out of UT. And they're coming out, and not super cheap, but they drive the salary point down because the demand is not as high. Because I know if I don't hire someone this semester, I'll just hire them next semester when they graduate. So that's why in Austin, it was really difficult for me to find. It's not now because I have more experience, but as an entry-level developer, it was very hard, almost impossible. I didn't find anything.
That's a real good point, because you can think of how many companies use internships with UT,
mm-hmm.
University of Texas.
And that's really your best way in
labor.
As a student. Yeah, exactly. But
it's great for the student, and it's great for you as a company.
Yes, and for the student, it almost guarantees them something when they get out of school,
right.
Whereas that wasn't really my situation. Whereas in Houston, and I get LinkedIn things all the time. I got a message from a guy yesterday in Boston asking about, hey, you know, you're a higher caliber Python developer. There's no one here in Boston. I was like, well, man, you gotta remember, right? It's supply and demand. So I told him, I said, if you open that position as remote, someone will hit it. And he's like, no, that's not what they want. And it's like, well, at this point, it's not really about what they want. Because if you're going after that talent and there's not a lot of it, they can kind of just do whatever they want. So no one's going to bite at that job to live in Boston because, I don't know if they have a super high.
If you want fresh, cheap lobster, go to Boston, the Cape Cod, whatever, you're going to get it. But there are other parts of the country, I'm sorry, if you want it, don't go there.
Well, and they're not, you have MIT next to there, but, you know, a lot of these guys, this is a quant firm, right? So they do financial, it's called quant, they do, I think it's quantitative, like, financial marker analysis, things like that. They monitor, like, stock market, but, like, from a software perspective. So there's companies that write software that play the stock market on, like, a microsecond level. So as it detects changes in markets and how they're distributed and how they're connected together, it will notice something happen over here. And through models and neural networks and machine learning, it'll detect where it predicts a dip.
Hmm.
So it'll buy in these dip markets and sell in the escalated markets, but all super, super fast. Like, it almost feels illegal, but those are quant firms, right? So they do, at least that's my understanding. I could be totally wrong, but I mean, that's from what my understanding is. But like I told this guy, hey, tell the client that no one's going to care if you want them to move to Boston. If you're not getting any bites, then they need to rework how they think about their job. And that's one of the cool things I like about this new company is they really respect and value the engineers. And that is, and they say it in their company, and I know it to be true from dealings with them, is you're their greatest asset. So that was a rabbit trail, sorry. The point that I was making about Austin and Houston.
We're trying to get beyond rabbit trails.
I know.
Remember?
I know. It's just, this pinged my, about supply and demand, right?
Right.
Like, there's a demand, but there's no supply, which is also another problem. Whereas here in Houston, there's not as many developers with my skill set. So I kind of have pick of the litter, or I get approached a lot. I'm not saying that I pass all the interview processes, but I'm saying I have a higher statistical chance of getting a job based on the exposure of people that want to give me a job or that are looking for talent like mine. Whereas in Austin, it's a different story. And that's why I picked Houston over Austin, because with lower supply, greater demand, it drives the salary up and you don't have as much competition. Which, the point that I'm making about the samurai search thing, that's where your sweet spot is. Everybody thinks, I want to start a company. Like what? It's going to be the new Google. Every investor will laugh your way. He'll laugh you out of his office. We don't need another Google. And if you create another thing similar to Google, they will crush you. So will Facebook. Now, I've heard that a few times. Oh, this is just going to be like Facebook, but it's going to be like 100 million times better. This is the greatest idea in the world. I only need X amount of dollars. Number one, I'm a bootstrap guy, so I try to do it on my own before I try to seek outside funding. But you have to stay in line with, if you're running a business, it has to deviate a little bit from your passion. Your passion is going to make your product good because you're good at what you do, like writing software. Or you're passionate about the subject or the thing that you're doing, right? If you're a passionate attorney, you will maintain clients because you're good at what you do. And if you love what you do, you will ultimately just get better at it based on practice.
And see, for you, you talked a while back about the possibility of teaching or training.
Mm-hmm.
You're a good communicator. You and I both know that a lot of the courses that some people take, and it doesn't really matter what the subject may be, there's not a ton of really good user-friendly, and I'm not saying easy, because there's those people out there that want to learn something and they want to take the easy route.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about, though, is communicated well, a package that's put together in a way that doesn't assume knowledge, but takes people at the basic level, but it's still interesting to work with. You would be good at doing something like that with even Python, because it's interesting to me that you're saying that there's not that many skilled Python programmers out there, and yet Python's been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem? Why aren't there more?
Well, the problem fundamentally is people are lazy and they don't pay attention. So when I was in high school, like, mom had to go to work, so I taught myself through high school. In doing that, I gained skills in learning that are not normal or natural or common in any way, shape, or form. Every language that I learned, I taught it to myself. So that's just kind of rare. There's not a lot of people like that. They do exist, but there's not a lot of people like that. Now, people see that and they see that passion and they're like, hey, you could teach me to do this. And it's like, hold the phone. That's not necessarily true. It depends on your learning style. It also depends if you go through something and you discover that you want to do it or not. The reason I don't do tutoring is, at a fundamental level, I'm trading time for money. My time is limited. It can't scale. I can only give one class at a time. So if I'm going to ever run a multi-million-dollar business, it can't just be me. If I was going to run a tutoring business, it would have to be something where I built some type of software as a service that I could farm out to companies, and then they would run their people through those courses. But you can find all this information on the internet, and the beautiful thing about the internet now is it's inundated with so much information that you're lost and you don't know where to look.
The only thing I would say though is that just like with whether you're writing a book, touting that you know all this kind of stuff, or teaching a course, mm-hmm. what are your credentials? If you have credentials that are recognized, then they say, "Oh, okay, yeah, I'll take a course from this guy," or
correct.
Read a tutorial from this guy.
And I don't. I'm not trying to shoot the idea. I like the idea, but the issue that I thought of this idea before, we've talked about it. The main issue that I've seen, and I've talked to recruiters, and I've posted this as a, hey, what do you think about this service? Most clients don't care about you teaching their engineers. They've already come to the realization, if they want to do Python, they've told these guys to go learn it, and they haven't. So it's not a problem of they don't know it and they can't learn it. They won't. It's a problem of, I would much rather you just come in and do it for me, and I'll pay you. And it's like, whoa, but I don't do that. The market dictates what it is you are going to do and what you're not going to do. So I can't come into a company and say, I'm going to teach all your engineers Python. They're going to be like, how about we not do that, and then you just do it yourself, and we'll pay you X amount of dollars an hour. So
it really kind of goes back to, in my mind, the picture of this guy who wants to teach his young student martial arts. But first of all, he wants to find out if he's worthy or if he's has the motivation that he needs. And so mm-hmm. he has to test him to see if he's going to hang in there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to be long, it's going to be hard, you're going to have to persevere.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, these guys in these companies, that they know that they probably should learn this, but time, the money,
yeah,
the pain.
It's too, yeah, it's hard to convince them, even with a force multiplier of I'm teaching them Python, they'll be more productive. Like, manager only wants them to do what it is they're supposed to do. So like learning, they don't see as like a, you know, training is like a, but I mean, what's the retention rate? How often do they retain the information? I don't know.
If they're not using it. Well, and like with you, because you have a passion for what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
you're using this stuff. You also bless with a good memory, which is really helpful. But if you're not using it, like your mother went and took a course, or her company sent her one time when she used to work for a big company. They sent her to learn Excel.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, well, they weren't, she didn't come back using it on the job. They didn't have her doing that at mm-hmm. that time, and so she lost it because she wasn't using it.
And you just assume that it'll, like, it's hard for me to keep up, and I love it. So it's not, you know, I don't want to belittle it, but it's an active thing that you have to do, and you have to act on it, and you have to constantly be learning. But I mean, I'm sure there comes a time in your life where, you know, you've been doing this for so long that you're like, I just don't want to learn that or keep up with the times.
Sure.
So you kind of fall off the wagon, which is totally natural.
So what are you going to do at this point? I know you're going to be on a bit of a, not necessarily a learning curve, but an understanding and maybe learning curve too with your new job, because you're starting that on Monday. So that's going to take up some time, just acclimating yourself to that new company.
Well, it's going to be challenging. I always try to pick the next job that's going to stretch me, and it's a little scary. So I don't ever trade apples for apples with jobs. I always trade it for where they're like, can you do this? And it's almost like, I'm 80% sure I can. But I mean, that's just how I am. And like, when I feel that I've outgrown a job, that's when I quit. And a lot of people would argue that, no, that's where you're comfortable and that's where you sit pretty. And then you, but that's not my goal is not to retire. My goal is to constantly learn and stretch myself in ways that are painful, that I can get better at things. So I think with this new job, I'll definitely be better at a lot of other things and exposed to a lot of really, really cool stuff.
Sure.
With the business side, like I was saying before about the sweet spot, the business side, the realm is still going. The realm is like a playground. Like, think of the realm as like my workshop, right? A lot of ideas come out of, you know, Henry Ford's workshop, one of them being the Model T. I'm sure a lot of other things came out of that workshop too. So working on the Realm for me is therapeutic. It kind of like scratches an itch that I have, and also like explores like far-reaching things that I can't exercise professionally or that I haven't found uses for business-wise. So it's almost kind of divided into two prongs. So the first side is the Realm being, you know, my pet project that, you know, it was cool to have it validated by this company to say, dude, this is massive. So, and this is coming from engineers that are like, this is quite an undertaking. So that felt reassuring, because I felt scared of it because it was a huge undertaking, but I didn't know if other engineers would be like, ah, that's easy. So that was awesome and validating. So there's that side of it. The other side of it is the Cosmopod business, right? So the thing I'm doing with my wife. For that side, like I was talking about with the sweet spot, I have to find something that I'm good at doing. That's another lesson. Don't do things that you're not good at. I'm going to mine gold. You've never mined in your life. You have no idea or perspective on what on earth is going on. So I'm going to do what I'm good at, which is Python. I'm going to find a niche. It doesn't have to be a million people. And I'm going to find that service that people want. It doesn't have to be a hair on fire thing. It could be hair on fire, meaning I'm going to sell you a bucket of water. Your hair's on fire. You want it now, right? I don't think your product has to be like amazing for that to happen. But maybe in your niche market, that's where you're hitting it. So I'm hitting those 1,000 people, my minimum viable audience, with a service that they're not currently offered. It doesn't have to be amazing. It is amazing, but it doesn't have to be super complex.
Right.
Just be something simple like an app to remember what your license plate number is. Stupid things like that. Slightly more advanced. Finding 1,000 people. The other side too is doing your research. So like finding the service, the software as a service I've kind of signed on to because it's easy to maintain. There's not a lot of overhead. I can push out code. It can make money on its own without me. Which means I'm not trading time for money anymore. The product can grow exponentially without my intervention. Or if it does have it, then I have enough money to hire a team.
Right.
So I hit my 1,000 people. In the process of creating the product, I'm communicating with my tribe or that minimum viable audience, throwing things their way. Instead of giving them a finished product and them saying, I like this, but I didn't buy it because I hate that. It could be something super stupid, but by polling and constantly communicating with these people and getting feedback, I can make those adjustments so that I'm almost giving them what they want, which to them is an amazing experience. To me is obvious because I asked you for all the cheat codes or I asked you for all the answers and I put them all in and then I give you the product and you're like, wow, this is exactly what I was thinking. Of course it was because you gave me all the information. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So doing that, but making it simple, and then hitting my point as far as money that I can exit. Because in all honesty, what I want from my life is to run a business that runs itself and that I don't have to work.
So that you can do
more Realm stuff, stuff that I want
to
do.
It's not to sit back and
do nothing.
Go brain dead, which is the goal of some people when they think about making money. Coming up with the business so that they don't have to work and
exactly.
They can play all day.
Well, and then it's fun, and then it's not. See, like the problem with the Realm is it's so complex that when I approached it from the business side, if I was going to do home automation system installations, just installations is a nightmare. But now you're going to stack on troubleshooting and possible legal situations with you accidentally opening a door you weren't supposed to. It's a nightmare. I can get there. Right, but I need a few more businesses under my belt that are funding and putting lawyers on retainer. So finding that first product, and I've already achieved the first goal that I had for my life, which was getting a work from home position. It will give me more time because I don't have traffic. Not more time because I'm working on my things when I'm supposed to be working. I'm working on my passion, which makes me more passionate about the things that I'm doing on the side.
Right.
So I think the next goal for me is work on both. Work on the Realm because that's where a lot of cool ideas come from. And from that, find your service and then start working, researching, and talking to people about, you know, would you buy this?
go back to a second when you were talking to these engineers that were interviewing you for your current, your new position. They were saying that this, they believed that this was a mess. They were really impressed with it, you're saying.
They, I don't know if I would say, interviews are really weird. I never know, like, how, if you really think that, or it's just by relativity to other people that aren't doing it.
Well, that's nice.
I think they thought it was cool. Mm-hmm. Because with engineers, it's a slippery slope, right? I can tell you, that's super cool, but I may not be very impressed. You may have a business that you make, you know, sleeves for Starbucks cups. That's super cool. You're rich, but it's not very advanced, right? I'm not impressed with, like, I'm impressed with you having the foresight to, like, do something super small and stupid, and now you're rich. But engineers, it's like, you know, you look at some other code that's, like, machine learning and all that super cool stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think that they thought it was super cool. But programmers are skeptics, and they'll want to see the code, because they'll want to see, like, the machine learning stuff and what are you doing with that. But to your point, it was the first time I've ever had someone as a prospective employer look at that as a factor in deciding, yeah, I think that you jive with us. Mm-hmm. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, that's neat. It's always nice to be affirmed in what you're doing. I mean, you can have your little private world where you're working on your little private projects, mm-hmm. and all that, and get a certain amount of warm fuzzies from that. But it's always nice to have someone from the outside who's respected in the respectable in the community that this product, they know enough about what goes into it. So when they say, wow, it's not like, you know, your kid saying, wow, Dad.
Yeah, you did it.
Yeah, okay.
But in from the personal side, it was also, I wasn't going to throw up a website for any of the stuff that I'm building yet, because that's really scary. But if I put it on my resume, it offers a minimal amount of exposure to kind of, you know, throw it out there and see what people will say. Most of the time, I knew recruiters weren't going to read it at all and be like, huh, that's nice, I don't care. But for this one, and for this being a driving factor, it just really was cool to be affirmed like that. So that is another, like, more primal reason for doing it, is more for, like, validation.
Sure.
Of, like, kind of putting myself out there and seeing what happens.
That's neat.
But what about you? So that, to, in conclusion, my goal is, like, compensation replacement on a product with Realm going on indefinitely for the foreseeable future.
When we had, you and I had lunch the other day, we were talking about timelines, and that kind of stuck in my brain because we had also talked about, you know, setting goals and putting dates down, which ends up being a mistake in some cases, particularly if you really don't know how long something's going to take, and to use a date to club yourself over the head with, if I don't, I've got to get this done by this date, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Guilt has limited potential as a motivator, and it steals any kind of passion there might have been out of it, because mm-hmm. you feel like you have to, and so it's more like somebody with beating you with a whip than it is somebody encouraging you along with it.
Or you feel like, I'm never going to be successful if I don't do X, Y, Z.
Right. So that's the way I want to approach it now, and I think I will come up with some markers.
Mm-hmm.
What did you call them?
Milestones.
Milestones. As I'm looking at a little bit more, because then it's not a date or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid I was never going to finish this, and so when I started thinking about dates, I thought, well, maybe that'll do it. I'll just tell myself, you know, I'm going to get it done by this date, or I'll cut one finger off a month for every date that I go past it or something.
Well, have you thought, so in the milestones from the Realm, a milestone is a complete turnkey solution, meaning There are no missing pieces. It doesn't have all the pieces, but the two pieces that it has work end to end. Mm-hmm. Have you thought of, for, and this is just an idea, finish the book, but without all the pieces in it? See what I'm saying? Just like bare bones. And then going back over and continuing to flesh it out. Because at any given time, you could release the book. It doesn't mean it's going to be an awesome book, right? It may be Fast and Furious to the end.
No, that's not a bad idea. The next door neighbor who's been encouraging me had suggested something similar and saying, get the beginning and the end together and a few bits and pieces in the middle. Because it, as you say, gives you a skeleton to work with rather than just disjointed little islands of pieces that may or not fit together as a whole.
Or one piece is more fleshed out than the other.
And I think the skeleton, as I think more about this, the skeleton is helpful in that as you're working at individual pieces of the book, you're going to have a better feel for whether something fits in,
mm-hmm.
how it fits in,
or knowing what, if you change some, like you got rid of a character,
mm-hmm.
having that backbone, you know what the repercussions for that is down the line.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good point. Okay, so I'll...
I don't know, because we've talked before too, and you've said, because you have a highly active imagination, maybe it's better for you to feel like you're on the adventure with the characters and you don't even know how it's going to end. Or does that go round and round and never end? Or I don't know. I don't know how that is with writing. I don't know what process is, but I think every writer has a different process.
Especially when you're talking about fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And when you listen to how it is that certain people write fiction, they all have their own little secrets to how they juice up their mm-hmm. creativity.
And you don't know if it's, here's my plot line, oh, I need to sprinkle some twists over the top.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it's, I'm taking it because I'm taking the ride with the characters, and then all of a sudden something organically comes about, and then you just finesse it and make the turn sharper. I don't know. That I'm just telling you how it is for software. Me writing code and you writing words are totally different things. The only thing that I have to do as well as a writer is, like, you can't just do, like, half. Like, software doesn't work very well if it's half.
Yeah. Well, I guess we better call it a night.
So then your, what's your
That's
next?
That's what I'm going to
do. Your That's, next goal is?
My next goal is just what you
that
said.
That sounded vague. Oh, do the
whole thing.
Okay.
And not be so focused on trying to fill in so much of it.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm thinking, yeah, that may be a good key to helping me as I continue to fill in. I haven't been paying. I've been doing more of the segments of the book, but without having a real overarching.
That's the same problem that I have. That's why I had to stop doing due dates, and stop, because I always am thinking in the future about the next better thing about the realm when the realm doesn't even do anything yet.
Right.
And I'm trying to make it like, oh, it could do like iris scan, and dude, it can't do anything right now. Just make it do the thing, make it turn on the light, which you did, which is great. You did a great job. That does absolutely nothing for you. But so now that makes more sense to me, because we have the same issue in that. I like the fun, sexy stuff. And I don't like the, you know, build the plot. So in software, I'll write it real fast, and then I test it. In the test, or I don't know what that is for writing, but in the test is where you see all the, oh, wow, that's wrong, that doesn't work, that, and then you fix it. But I think getting to the finish line, maybe it'll do something for your brain. Maybe it's that it's not ended that bothers you, or I don't know. You can just try it, and then I'll try my
thing. See what happens, huh?
All right. And hopefully no more hurricanes. That'd be great.
No more excuses.
Okay, we'll see you next week for sure.
See ya.
Bye.